Welcome back to Star Trek Discovery Pod. My name is Mike Moody, and this is a Patreon preview episode of the podcast, which you can listen to in full by signing up at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. You can sign up at the $1 level to get the bonus content, and at the $2 level for the bonus content plus an invite to our Slack community, where you can hang with other Star Trek fans, get access to live watch parties, all kinds of cool stuff happening there. We also have a $5 tier that gets you all of that, plus a few more bonus gifts. So please join us at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. You can also visit our podcast website to get all the free episodes of the podcast at StarTrekPod.co. We really appreciate you listening and supporting us on Patreon. It's a great way to help us continue to produce the pod. And here's a preview of our podcast on Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Enjoy.
This movie definitely was not what I had in my mind for what this movie was going to be. Mm-hmm. Undiscovered Country. I thought they were finding some planet that was undiscovered, like Undiscovered Country, Undiscovered Planet. They were going to try and help some new species reintegrate with the rest of Starfleet society or something. That's kind of what I thought might be happening with this movie. Or as the plot started to kind of unfold in the beginning of the movie, I was like, oh, okay. The Klingons are losing their home world and their society, and they're going to have to move to another place in order to be a sustainable species. So they're going to find some undiscovered planets to repopulate for them. This is kind of piggybacking maybe off of what was going on with Genesis, and that'll be an interesting tie-in. It wasn't that at all. It was neither of those things. But at the same time, I was taken by how much this movie contrasted what a monstrosity that fifth movie was. It took itself very seriously. I thought, you know, with the exception of what I agree with Mariah, the dialogue being really heavy-handed in the Shakespeare references, I thought that the acting and the tone for everything was consistent and serious and actually kind of intense throughout. I was engaged with the plot, and I loved the prison sequence that goes on with Bones and Kirk and Iman.
I know. Iman
and the shape-shifting.
Great. Yeah.
The whole thing was so cool. And then how everything kind of brought them all together and concluded was actually, I felt it was like beautiful, poignant, powerful, and did justice to the legacy of these characters. I felt it. I ranked my movies, and I put this in my number two spot behind the Whales movie.
Nice. So after seeing all these movies, do you kind of get why, like, somebody like me who saw these when he was younger and watched them over and over, like, loves Star Trek so much?
I get it. Yeah.
Guys, I love this movie.
We knew this. Shocking.
It's super solid. It's got a great mystery at its center. It's got cracking political intrigue. It's a sharp social and political allegory that also serves as a potent piece of universe building for the franchise. And like you said, Grant, like following the mess of Star Trek V, this is such a 180 degree turn in the right direction. This one, it has a focused plot that defines the stakes right at the outset, and it really delivers. It's a totally the opposite of Part 5. It's sophisticated. The tone, the plotting. For a Star Trek movie, it's very sophisticated. It also has a lot of understated, goofy comedy, but this time I think it works really well, like it didn't work in Part 5. The action set pieces are super cool. The characters all seem like they're true to the original series characters and where they are at this point in the series. It's also very literate in a kind of a goofy, fun kind of way. I think we covered that.
I'm not done.
This was just a really good one for the TOS crew to go out on together. Like at the end, when they save the day and Kirk is standing in the middle of the frame and everybody's applauding, like they did that in part four after they saved the world. It felt earned then. Here it felt like we kind of had to get there for the movie, but it also felt earned too. This is just a great, like Grant said, that ending was poignant and beautiful and just a great way for them to go out.
I was kind of struck by how this movie in particular, but I guess the original series film franchise, how I've seen that inform a lot of other movies going forward. Like I see a bunch of Guardians of the Galaxy did a bunch of references clearly to these films in stuff that they did. And I'm like, oh, okay, you were borrowing from this stuff, but I wasn't seeing those kind of parallels or those kind of reference points because I'd never seen the Star Trek movies. And now I'm like, there's some good homage going on between a lot of these other films I've seen since then. And it's interesting to see how these films have had that impact on the future of sci-fi films.
Yeah, like have you seen that COVID gif with people talking about the states that are opening up, and it's a gif of Kirk saying, "Let them die." It's from this movie.
That's true.
Let them die.
So what's really cool about this movie, the central story is a political allegory that hews really closely to the cooling of tensions during the Cold War between the U.S. and Russia. And right. That helps the plot feel really grounded, and it legitimizes everything in a way that Star Trek V couldn't even come close to. They even go as far as having Spock say, "There's an old Vulcan proverb, only Nixon can go to China," to Kirk. When Kirk complains about having to escort the Klingons to the peace summit because he hates them because they killed his son. And the Spock quote is a very sly reference to Nixon, of course, visiting China in the early 70s because he was the hardline anti-communist leader with a lot of influence that sort of made him critic-proof to go and negotiate a peace with China. And that's kind of who Kirk is at the beginning of this movie.
Only Trump could go to North Korea.
Only Trump can go to hell.
Now we go, ugh.
That was like, was my frown not audible? Yeah.
We long for the days of Nixon going to China. Let's talk about... Oh, yeah. There's also the Klingon moon explosion due to over-mining, which is supposed to be influenced by the Chernobyl disaster.
Right.
Some more allegory there. Chancellor Gorkon, the Klingon chancellor, was influenced by Gorbachev. That's why his name is kind of has a gore in it. Myers has been quoting it
down
saying,
that wall.
Exactly. I really like that character of Gorkon. He's very diplomatic and honorable and kind of quietly burdened by having to be the one to negotiate this peace.
Right. He's kind of quite a contrast. In fact, I'd say a lot of these characters were quite a contrast to the caricatures that I had seen thus far of what a Klingon is. Just angry, hot-headed, not a shred of diplomacy, except maybe the guy in Star Trek V, the bigger dude who was like kind of the washout drunk or something. Yeah. That, like helped to negotiate some.
Damn
like,
you, sir. You will deal. Try.
Yeah. Well, fine. I'll get back into it. Whatever.
I'm sure you become more diplomatic, though, as soon as you realize your planet is going to die within 50 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, I was intrigued by the intro in which clearly they needed to escalate this idea that Kirk... We need to establish right from the beginning that Kirk is not going to be okay with the Klingons. He hates them with a passion so that he's won over by the end, right? But like having some other people echo this same kind of sentiment, the other guy who ends up being the villain in the end.
Admiral Cartwright.
And I like that they established this early on, like, oh, this is going to be something that Kirk needs to work to overcome his prejudices here. But even then, it seemed a little bit like forced that he would be like so hot-headed and so betrayed by Spock putting him as the person to go and usher them to this negotiation treaty thing. And this is my complaint that I've said in like all these movies, Kirk is not the guy to be a diplomat. Every time it's Kirk, shit goes sideways. I don't know why they would keep sending this guy. Sure, he ends up working it out in the end, but I bet these things could go a lot more smoothly if it just wasn't him in the first place.
I beg to differ with that. I think this would have gone down like the Klingon plot. Well, it was the Klingons and the Federation trying to undermine the whole peace treaty thing, the whole peace treaty deal. So even if Kirk wasn't there, it would have gone down. But I hear what you're saying. That the depiction of the Federation hardliners against the Klingons is like really blunt. And I think that's a strength of the movie. Like the admirals down to the ensigns are all saying like racist things about the Klingons. There was a line that they gave to Nichelle Nichols where she's supposed to say, I guess talking with Scotty or Chekhov, like, would you let one of them date your daughters? And she refused.
Ooh, for real?
She refused to say it. So they struck it from the script for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty wild. Yeah.
Pretty tone deaf of them.
A little
too.
Bit.
I mean,
yeah.
I get how they want to play up to the parallels, but kind of slow your roll a little bit.
I feel like then you're mixing the metaphor because if the Klingons are supposed to be like communism and Russia, like it's a whole different, like then it would have been almost funnier to have Chekhov saying something along those lines.
Yeah.
Like,
let's talk about the opening scene. I think it's super cool in a lot of ways. First, we get to see Sulu in command of his own ship. He's not part of the Enterprise anymore. And I think it's a good idea to have Sulu as the guy who gets his own command because he always seemed to me like a commander just in the way he acts and the way he's depicted throughout the series. And he's in command of the Excelsior, which he expressed an interest in all the way back in Star Trek III, if you guys remember that. And
he expressed interest in Excelsior?
Yeah.
He was this was an already established ship or something?
Yeah, this is the one that Scotty sabotages in part 3.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But Sulu was all interested in it because it has transwarp drive.
It's got a hefty booty to it, whatever that part of the ship is. But
it's a butt.
It's a butt. I figured it's a butt. It's very, it's got a lot of dumps in that truck.
And then there's that super cool explosion that comes out of nowhere, and the Klingon on the view screen is obviously in distress. And then the Klingons put out this fake news bulletin, like, everything's okay. It's fine. Don't look at us. It's just a great beginning that sets the tone, like, really well.
Yeah.
Very Chernobyl callbacks.
Very much.
I also really like, pretty early on in the film, we get introduced to Kim Cattrall, who I think does a wonderful job with her performance throughout this whole movie. And she's coming off of like a good wave of just doing like Big Trouble in Little China. And so she's like a pretty big name get, I think, for this sort of villainy Vulcan character.
I didn't know that was Kim Cattrall. Oh, that's awesome.
What?
I kept looking at her and going, man, you look familiar.